from VOA in Washington, this is Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. A nuclear deal with Iran was again front and center in Washington. And not just because the U.S. and other world powers prepared to begin another round of talks in hope of reaching a final settlement by June 30th. In a rare moment of bipartisanship, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed a bill allowing Congress a say in reviewing any agreement that is reached. After a few modest changes, the White House, which had said President Obama would veto the measure for meddling in his ability to conduct foreign policy, decided to withdraw its opposition. On the eve of a new round of talks, Russia announced it would sell $800 million worth of sophisticated surface-to-air missiles to Iran. The Russians claimed the missiles were for defensive purposes only and did not violate Western sanctions against Iran, but the development was received poorly by the Obama administration and Israel. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi visited Washington and agreed to disagree about Saudi Arabian airstrikes in Yemen. Abadi said the strikes raised the specter of wider sectarian turmoil in the region. President Obama pronounced his support for the Iraqi regime and agreed to give the Iraqis more military aid, but it wasn't clear he was prepared to approve some of the more sophisticated offensive weapons Baghdad is seeking. Meanwhile, the 2016 presidential race gathered new momentum with the formal announcement of two heavyweights, one Democrat and one Republican. Senator Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American and Republican, said he planned to be the face of the future, criticizing some other candidates as the face of yesterday. On the other side of the aisle, Hillary Rodham Clinton, to the surprise of nobody, entered the race heavily favored to win the Democratic nomination. She also said she would run a campaign to make America's future brighter, emphasizing policies to begin the middle class. Well, let's start, instead of domestic politics, let's start with geopolitics here. Stephen, let's talk about these talks, which we're going to resume in a few days here to try to turbocharge the deal. But before that, I think we should talk about the congressional logjam, which has apparently been broken here. And I think it was broken because President Obama agreed to give Congress an opportunity to assess any nuclear deal. But the Republicans made some changes to their legislation. Tell us about that, and what do you think about it?
Right. You know, we've had this long-running dispute between the White House, not just Republicans on Capitol Hill. Some Democrats are quite skeptical of this Iran deal. So all along, President Obama insisted that this isn't a treaty. He has no obligation to send this to Congress. The big problem is that many of the sanctions that are going to be lifted, supposedly under this deal, are congressional sanctions. So in the end, they will require Congress to weigh in. I think they've come up with Bob Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has done quite a good job in coming up with an elegant solution, which does represent a climb down for the president. He is allowing Congress to have a say, but there's almost a safety valve in this. Even if Congress gets the deal, passes a bill decrying the deal, he can veto that. Then it goes back to the Congress, and there has to be this process whereby each house has to get a two-thirds majority to overturn a veto. In that scenario, I think it's unlikely that even Democrats who vote to sort of decry the deal will then vote against the president's veto. He only needs really to hang on to 34 Democrats in the Senate to allow this deal to go forward. So I think it does represent a climb down by the White House, but it's a climb down in such a way that will not, I think, necessarily derail the diplomatic process and cause Iran to walk away from the table, which was the White House's big fear all along.
Tim, as I understand it, one of the sticking points that was resolved, at least for the moment, is that Congress won't be able to weigh in until after a deal is reached. I mean, I think the president was worried that Congress might be in a position where they could express disapproval legislatively before there was a deal. I gather that problem has been taken care of now.
Well, there's been a lot of tension over the last 6 months about whether or not Congress might, for example, move ahead with additional sanctions before the Iranian negotiations have even completed. So Congress has stepped back a little bit from that, and it decided to give the Obama administration a little bit more time to come to this framework agreement, this tentative framework agreement that we saw earlier this month, a couple weeks ago. Now what we're seeing is Congress taking yet another step back and saying, hey, we will allow you to finish whatever deal it is that you're negotiating with Iran before weighing in, which is a win for the Obama administration. Where the Obama administration has backed down is where, like Stephen said, it is said, well, we will not veto this effort to have congressional weigh-in, congressional opinion expressed after the deal is reached. I'm not sure I agree with Stephen in the sense that I think that the Senate is more likely to be able to present a veto-proof majority. Where I think there should be some concern is actually the House, which has been relatively quiet, even though it's Republican-controlled, has been for some time, and has some of the most hawkish lawmakers in all of Washington, D.C. What the House is that it has a House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is not that aggressive right now about pushing sanctions or pushing this Corker bill. And we'll have to see whether Elliot Engel, the top Democrat on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, or Ed Royce, the Republican, who is the chairman of that committee, they're going to push very strongly on this Corker bill. I'm not sure that they will.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the legislative impasse has at least for the moment been finessed. Let's focus just for a second on the talks that will be resuming soon. Stephen, how do you sense the state of play is on the merits of a deal or not a deal?
It's going to be interesting because we had the big fanfare of the deal supposedly being agreed a few weeks ago. Since then, it appears that the United States and Iran have clearly different perceptions of what they actually agreed during the talks. You've had several sort of vehement statements by the supreme leader of Iran that basically say, okay, so as soon as there is a final deal, which is due by the end of June, all the sanctions against Iran will be lifted. The U.S. position is that what they've agreed is that sanctions will be lifted more gradually, in line with Iranian compliance to the deal. Now, there's some reason to think that this is all politics, you know, that the Iranians are just saying this for political reasons, for their own reasons, but we're going to find out whether it's politics or if there's real deep disagreements.
We'll come back to this in a moment, but first, time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
My name is Cal Perry. I've been at Voice of America now for 2 years. In 2001, 9/11 happened, and that propelled me to find a job in media. They were looking for young people who were willing to go with the U.S. military into Baghdad and film that. It was the highest high to the lowest low. There was moments that you found yourself crying over something you had seen, and then moments of absolute elation of witnessing history. I met my wife in Libya. We both kind of realized that in order to have a family and have to take a step back, I was interested in returning to D.C. where I grew up and found a home in Voice of America, a place that's really changing. People are searching for a place where they can find accurate information. The Internet's changed that. Social media's changed that. VOA does a very good job of providing historical context to our audience overseas, context that you may not find everywhere.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Tom DeFrank with Stephen Collinson and Tim Mack. Tim, I want to throw this to you about I'd like to get your take on the state of the nuclear talks and tell me how you think the Russian arms deal, which Vladimir Putin seems to be very proud of and is insisting that it doesn't affect anything and, in fact, might help get a deal. I don't know. I'm not sure about his logic. But tell me how you think that affects, if at all, the quest for a deal here.
Yeah. On the deal itself, obviously, there's a lot of negotiation, left to go. They're quite far away if one position thinks that sanctions would immediately be lifted and another side believes that sanctions will be gradually lifted with compliance and reassurance that the Iranians are going to be going along with what they said they would. On the arms deal, what Russia has decided to open the door to is to sell a missile defense system called the S-300, or in NATO parlance, what's called a gargoyle. And what it does is it can shoot down incoming enemy missiles, and it can shoot down incoming enemy fighters and bombers. And what it essentially would do from the geopolitical sphere is it would make it much more difficult to launch an attack on Iran. If Iran had these systems set up at strategic points, it would be very difficult for American strikes or any other country to strike at the heart of the country, especially its nuclear facilities. So what it does is it makes it more difficult for the military option to be used in the future should Iran renege on some of the details of this negotiated deal.
So it's still there's still an option that we will have a deal, but if there is one, it could be much more difficult. I think you're saying if the Israelis decide that they need to launch a strike down the road, if Iran reneges on a deal,
much more difficult to enforce the deal if the Iranians decide not to comply.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about Iran in the next couple of weeks and probably the next few months. We'll have to see. Again, both sides are hoping for a deal by June the 30th. We'll see if that happens. Most timetables in this process have slid. They've proven to be more optimistic. So we will see whether this one is the same. But now let's go to Iraq. Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi was in Washington. First trip here since he took over as prime minister, greeted warmly by President Obama in the Oval Office. They had a press conference, but I think it became clear, listening to both leaders, that Abadi wanted more big-time weapons, and he's probably not going to get them. What's going on here, Stephen?
Right. There's always been this tension since the Abadi regime or government came into power, that they want more sophisticated U.S. weapons. They're obviously facing a fight against ISIS, in which the U.S. is helping. You know, there is still some disquiet on the U.S. side about sending these kind of high-tech weapons to a government where you're not quite sure if they may remain in the government forces' hands. It's a pretty porous situation, the Iraqi army, people coming in and out. There's a big militia influence, so that's interesting. The most interesting part of his visit, though, was actually Mr. Abadi gave an interview to some American journalists and basically vigorously criticized the Saudi offensive in Yemen. And not only did he criticize it, he said that the United States shares Iraqi concern about this offensive. The White House quickly came out and said, well, that's not the case. They don't share this concern about this offensive. Even though I think there are some serious concerns privately in the White House in the way in which al-Qaeda in Yemen has been able to exploit the anarchy in Yemen during this Saudi campaign against the Houthi rebels. But, you know, this was put the White House in a very difficult position. It exemplifies the calculations that the White House is having to make in the Middle East, because you had a Shiite leader allied with Iran, decrying the actions of a U.S. ally, a U.S. Sunni ally in Yemen, and the United States are on kind of both sides of this equation. So it was a very delicate moment.
And the Saudis, of course, fired back. The Saudi ambassador to the United States said, in effect, to the Iraqi prime minister, mind your own business. Take care of what you're doing. We're going to do what we're going to do. So it is a delicate dance. It's a delicate diplomatic minuet here. But Tim, I'm still not clear whether Abadi and his government is going to be more effective than their predecessor government in solving the problem of the Islamic State without more military aid than Washington is prepared to give them at the moment.
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen. But the Obama administration does have more faith in this Iraqi government than the previous administration. That's at least fair to say. The Iraqi government, supported by militias and by, let's not forget, Iranian military advisors, have made some progress into Crete, and they are launching some offensives. We do see that ISIS is losing some key ground in Iraq, not in Syria, but in Iraq. And so I think there are signs that some of these military operations are being effective.
Well, we will see. We'll be talking about this forever as well. But now let's go back to domestic American politics. I can remember when George W. Bush decided to run for president in 2000. He announced in June of 1999, first in Iowa and then in New Hampshire in the same day. And everybody that I talked to thought that was horrendously early to be starting almost 18 months before the balloting in November of 2000. But those were light years away. Now we have several candidates already announced, and two of the heavier hitters are already in. And let's start with Marco Rubio. Tim, you were in Miami for Rubio's announcement speech. He is a fresh face, and he's, relatively speaking, he's a kid. He's 44 years old. He announced in Miami at a building where Cuban immigrants were once processed into the United States. He is a Cuban-American. His parents fled from Cuba before the shortly before the revolution. He talked a lot about he is the candidate of the future.
Yeah.
And everybody else, in effect, he said, is a yesterday's person. How do you think his rollout was, and what do you think his prospects are?
You know, his rollout was quite exciting. It took place, like you said, in Freedom Tower, which has a lot of historical resonance for Cuban Americans. And he is a young, fresh pace. He's in his early 40s. He is relatively new on the scene, only emerged about 5-6 years ago as kind of a Tea Party insurgent. It'll be very interesting to see how far he gets.
Well, we will see. Time for another break. We'll be right back with some final thoughts.
Life Talk is an hour-long radio and television program in English, Shona, and Ndebele.
The Women's Forum is a response to a call from our own listeners.
Madzimai Eko Studio 7, achitaura nemi.
Women issues need to be covered in depth.
This is an opportunity to women to interact and share ideas.
On Assignment really is designed to be your backstage pass to VOA reporting all around the world.
But what VOA On Assignment does is to put you in the driver's seat with that reporter. So you would see things as a reporter sees it.
We allow our reporters to tell us the details that they weren't able to include in their stories.
VOA Economics Editor Jim Randall, thank you so much.
VOA On Assignment puts a human face to the stories of our correspondents.
That's really what it's all about.
Free podcasts of VOA Issues in the News are available on Apple iTunes.
This is Issues in the News on VOA. Now back to you, Tim. Keep talking about Rubio, because it was interesting to me. He seemed to be indirectly criticizing his mentor, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who has not announced but is running, when he talked about yesterday's candidates, and he clearly was criticizing Hillary Clinton as a yesterday's candidate. And yet some critics have already said how forward-looking is Rubio, other than the fact that he's a young man in his 40s. He's against gay marriage. He's against climate change. He's against the Obama administration's policy of of some kind of a detente with Cuba. So does that really position him to make the argument that he's making?
Yeah, it's very clear that when he's talking about the candidates of yesterday, he's talking about your Jeb Bushes and your Hillary Clintons. And when he says he's the candidate of the future, you're right. I mean, his policies do not seem all that dynamic or innovative. He's not that extreme. He's very much in the mainstream of the Republican Party. But when he says he's the candidate of the future, what he really means is my personal history is a candidacy for the future. That is, that my narrative is going to speak louder than a lot of the policies I'm going to put out there. That he, as a young immigrant in America who came from nothing, has made himself into something.
Stephen, another criticism of Rubio by some pundits, by some skeptics, is that he has this fundamental problem. He is more moderate a conservative than a lot of what I would call the far right of the Republican Party. And I think others also say President Obama has given first-term senators a bad name because one of the enduring criticisms of President Obama is that maybe he was not sufficiently experienced as a first-term U.S. senator to be ready for the presidency. I hear that a lot. Admittedly, I hear it from people who don't think Rubio is a good guy. Do you think this is going to be a problem for him?
I think he has a difficult route to the nomination. First of all, he's running somewhat for the establishment wing of the party, which is going to presumably be represented by Jeb Bush, who's got substantial fundraising ability. And, you know, as you said, there's this criticism that he's a first-term senator. Rubio would answer that by saying, well, the problem with President Obama was not necessarily that he was only a first-term senator. The problem was that he was wrong on all the fundamental foreign policy issues of the time. So in that sense, that's how Rubio is going to answer that.
Well, I tend to agree with you that he's a bit of a long shot, but I must tell you, I had breakfast a few days ago with one of Rubio's senior campaign strategists, and he said, here is our strategy. Jeb Bush is the front runner. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, is slightly behind Jeb Bush, and we are a strong, robust third. And our strategy is to position ourselves for the inevitability that Scott Walker, never having spent a day in Washington, really, will make some rookie mistakes and will falter. And at that point, if that happens, Rubio then can be poised to move up to go head-to-head against his former former Governor Jeb Bush. We will see about that. It's a long way to go, but I think Rubio's chances are slightly less than 50-50, but we'll see. But let's talk about another candidate who we've been talking about from these microphones for 20 years, probably longer, and that's Hillary Rodham Clinton. I remember, Tim, a few days before the 1992 presidential election, one of his aides told me that Bill Clinton had said, you know, if I lose this election, I'm going to feel sorry for myself for 1 week, take a vacation, and then I'm going to come back and start all over again, and I will win next time, mainly because I will have learned from all the stupid things I did in this campaign. Now, we don't have enough time left to talk about all of Hillary Clinton's missteps in 2008. So it's hard to know, but do you think that she has learned from her mistakes last time around?
Not from the early days of the campaign. I think, you know, this email scandal has really reemphasized some of the worst natures of the Clintons and the people that surround them, their desire generally for privacy, for secrecy, and not being particularly transparent. I think you'll see that being emphasized over and over again during this campaign.
Right. Okay. And Stephen, I wanted to come back to you because you were in Iowa for the rollout, accompanied by hordes of reporters who didn't have a whole lot of access to her. How do you think Hillary 2.0 began in Iowa? How successful was that?
In terms of her own political, start, I think it was successful. Like you said, she's learned from her mistakes in Iowa, particularly where she took the state for granted last time. She didn't give Iowans the kind of close-up scrutiny and conversation that they like in their primary candidates. So in terms of purely the Iowa situation, I think her strategy of small events And with a slow start was actually quite a shrewd beginning to her campaign.
Well, we'll see. We got 19 months to go. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zaleski and John Walker. Our engineer was Bill Barber. I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. Thanks for listening.